What role did the CIA play in enticing Japan to embrace nuclear power after the atomic bombings of Hiroshima and Nagasaki? Can nuclear power be utilized as a remedy for climate change? Are there institutional ties between the Japanese and Canadian nuclear industries? How resilient is the anti-nuclear movement within Japan, and how has the Fukushima Daiichi nuclear disaster impacted the resistance? On this week's Global Research News Hour, we continue our commemoration of the 6th anniversary of the Fukushima Daiichi nuclear meltdowns by examining the origins of the Japanese nuclear sector and the political context within which it is situated. Our guests this hour include Peter Kuznick, history professor and director of the American University-based Nuclear Studies Institute, Gordon Edwards of the Canadian Coalition for Nuclear Responsibility, and Eileen Miyoko Smith, director of Green Action Japan, a Kyoto-based NGO. On this week's program, Fukushima Anniversary, Japan's historic love-hate relationship with nuclear power. Bringing you the analysis beyond the media headlines, the Global Research News Hour is on the air. Welcome to the Global Research News Hour for the week of March 24th, 2017. I'm series host and producer Michael Welch. The Global Research News Hour is a special radio collaboration between the Center for Research on Globalization and campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg on occupied Anishinaabe territory on the homeland of the Métis Nation. We seek to provide you with access to analysis of the major issues shaping our world today, from thinkers, researchers, and unique political personalities rarely addressed by major media. Our program is available from the Center's website, globalresearch.ca. We can also be heard on the Progressive Radio Network at prn.fm. We'll begin our show with News Notes, a sampling of articles from the Global Research News site. Are we to conclude that America's corrupt and disloyal quote-unquote intelligence agencies are a direct threat to democracy, that they are committed to overthrowing Trump's presidency in a color revolution, that unable to provide any evidence whatsoever for their conspiracy theory of a Trump-Putin collusion to steal the presidential election, the quote-unquote intelligence agencies have moved on to discredit the independent internet media that are in the way of the quote-unquote intelligence agencies' control over explanations? It is a hard fact that the Democrats, U.S. quote-unquote intelligence, and the prostitutes are absolutely determined to control the explanations given to the American people and the wider world. The agents are out in full force, and Neo is nowhere in sight. The demonization of Russia and the extraordinary level of tension that the ignorant and foolish Clinton, George W. Bush, and Obama regimes created with Russia are disconcerting, indeed frightening, to those such as myself, Patrick Buchanan, and Stephen Cohen, who experienced the long decades of the Cold War. We've never seen such highly provocative, entirely gratuitous behavior of one nuclear power toward another as the behavior of the U.S. toward Russia over the past 6 presidential terms. That comes from the article, "The FBI's Conspiracy Theory of a Trump-Putin Collusion Has No Clothes," by Dr. Paul Craig Roberts, posted March 23rd. On March 20th, intelligence expert James Bamford discussed a multi-billion dollar U.S. spy agency you haven't heard of, saying, "The National Geospatial Intelligence Agency, or NGA, is located on a, quote, heavily protected military base some 15 miles south of Washington," unquote. Few Americans know about its massive headquarters, larger than the CIA's or U.S. Capitol. Completed in 2011 at a cost of $1.4 billion, the main building measures 4 football fields long and covers as much ground as 2 aircraft carriers, Bamford explained. In 2016, the agency purchased 99 acres in St. Louis to construct additional buildings at a cost of $1.75 billion to accommodate the growing workforce with 3,000 employees already in the city. That comes from the article, "The National Geospatial Intelligence Agency, NGA, Washington's Little-Known Spy Agency," by Stephen Lendman, posted March 23rd. Top security experts agree that mass surveillance makes us more vulnerable to terrorists. Indeed, even the NSA admits that it's collecting too much information to stop terror attacks. In virtually every recent terror attack, in Boston, Paris, San Bernardino, Orlando, etc., the suspect was already on a terror watch list, known to authorities, previously interviewed by the FBI or the like. They were already known to authorities. Mass surveillance simply doesn't keep us safer. That comes from the article, 10 Ways to Reduce Terrorism. Now Can We Admit the War on Terror Has Failed? By Washington's blog, posted March 23rd. Palestinians are under occupation. It is not their own responsibility to negotiate with the occupier. For sure, it is not part of any negotiation whether to maintain or end occupation. Negotiation may be on the modalities on how to do that only. So far, Palestinians are in a weak position. They are requested to choose pacific means to reach liberation and end occupation, while at the same time they are asked to negotiate directly with an occupier who continues to confiscate land day on day out. It is the responsibility of the international community to put an end to one of the last occupations in the world. That comes from an interview by Edu Montesanti with Dr. Asim Khalil under the headline, Palestine, There's No Conflict, There's an Illegal Occupation, posted March 23rd. Seven non-members of the non-deep state are so enraged by the idea that people might think the totally fake American deep state might be real that they accidentally publish seemingly coordinated attacks on the very idea. Under very similar titles, all within the same few days, citing the same counterexamples of Egypt and Turkey, all acting with symmetrical umbrage. That comes from the article, There Is No American Deep State, It Just Looks Like There Is, by Kit, posted March 23rd, originally appearing at Off Guardian. These are just a few of the featured articles appearing last week on the Global Research website. Regular visitors to the site are encouraged to send monetary contributions by fax, mail, or online. Just go to globalresearch.ca and click Donate on the menu bar. According to the International Atomic Energy Agency, the island nation of Japan is the home of to 42 operating nuclear reactors. Only two other nations on Earth, the United States and France, boast a larger number of reactors. Japan is well acquainted with the hazards of nuclear energy, having suffered from two nuclear bomb blasts in World War II, and of course, the catastrophic meltdowns on Fukushima Prefecture 6 years ago. So how does one account for Japan's disproportionate interest in nuclear energy? To discuss this question, we're joined by Peter Kuznick. He is professor of history at American University in Washington, D.C., and director of that institution's Nuclear Studies Institute. He is co-author with Akira Kimura of Rethinking the Atomic Bombings of Hiroshima and Nagasaki, Japanese and American Perspectives, and co-author with Yuki Tanaka of a Japanese book which translates as Nuclear Power in Hiroshima, The Truth Behind the Peaceful Use of Nuclear Power. He also worked on The Untold History of the United States, a 10-part Showtime documentary film series and book co-authored with Oliver Stone. He joins us now from Washington, D.C. Pleasure to have you join us, Professor Kuznick.
Pleasure is mine, Michael.
Now, I don't think you can separate the development of nuclear power in Japan from Washington's geostrategic ambitions. Could you explain what role did Washington see Japan playing in this post-war world?
Well, the United States had a vision of Japan as the fulcrum for our policies in Asia, which meant that we were going to have to build up Japan economically, especially after the Chinese Revolution. So Japan becomes a counterweight to China in America's strategic thinking. But the history of America's role in nuclear power power development in Japan actually takes a different kind of turn. And that's in part much more a function of Eisenhower's overall defense policy. Eisenhower's president in the United States from 53 to 61, Eisenhower initially actually was opposed to the atomic bombing of Hiroshima and Nagasaki. When Secretary of War Stimson told Eisenhower at Potsdam that the United States was about to drop atomic bombs on Japan, Eisenhower said he got very depressed, and then Stimson asked him for his opinion, and Eisenhower said, "I'm against it on two counts. First, the Japanese are ready to surrender, and second of all, they don't want to see our country be the first to use such a terrible weapon." And Eisenhower always stuck to that version of events. He had company among America's military leaders. As you might know, seven of America's eight five-star admirals and generals in 1945 are on record as being opposed to the atomic bombing, either saying it was militarily unnecessary, morally reprehensible, or both. And so Eisenhower was part of that mindset. He knew that the atomic bombs were necessary. And then he wanted to see the atomic bombs be taken over by the United Nations and not the United States to develop its own nuclear arsenal. He did not want a nuclear arms race. However, by the time he's president, his thinking has changed to a large degree. Eisenhower's strategy as president was that he feared excessive defense spending by the United States. And his antidote to the excessive defense spending, which he thought would bankrupt the United States, was to rely on nuclear weapons. So Eisenhower actually oversees the development of the nuclear arsenal. When Eisenhower takes office in early 53, the United States has approximately 1,000 nuclear weapons. When Eisenhower leaves office in early 61, the United States has more than 22,000 nuclear weapons. When his budgeting cycle is finished, the United States has 30,000 nuclear weapons. So Eisenhower, because my students, I ask them, you know, what's your image of Eisenhower? What they usually know is Eisenhower's farewell address and his warning about the military-industrial complex. What they don't know is that Eisenhower did more than anybody else to build the military-industrial complex. And that Eisenhower knew what he was talking about when he warned against the dangers of the military-industrial complex. So he wanted to rely increasingly on nuclear weapons. And he says quite early on, he says, we're going to use the nuclear weapons just like we'd use a bullet or anything else. So Eisenhower's strategy was to erase the line between conventional weapons and nuclear weapons. But because we have the minutes of the National Security Council meetings at which Dulles says, you know, we can't use the nuclear weapons. There's such a taboo against it. So the goal for the Eisenhower administration was to figure out a way to make nuclear weapons use more palatable in the 1950s. And the strategy that they explicitly adopted was that they could sell the military atom if they develop this, if they propagandize around the use of the peaceful atom. In December of 1953, Eisenhower makes a famous speech before the UN General Assembly, in which he is called his Atoms for Peace speech. And he talks about how the United States is going to lead the world in spreading the peaceful use of nuclear power. He'd been warned already by the scientists in the United States that this program is bogus, that's going to lead to military proliferation of nuclear weapons. But Eisenhower ignored that and embraced this anyway, seeing it as the only way he could legitimize America's vast nuclear buildup. And so the United States begins this policy of promoting the peaceful atom at home and overseas.
It must have taken more than just a public relations campaign to get Japan on side, no?
Absolutely, because Japan had a much more negative view of nuclear weapons, having been the victim of the atomic bombings in Hiroshima and Nagasaki, than any other country did. And so when Eisenhower decides to promote the peaceful atom in Japan explicitly, there's tremendous resistance. We initiate the program really in 54, but shortly thereafter, you've got the Lucky Dragon 5 incident. during the Bravo test in the Bikini Island, in the Bikinis, it's a vast nuclear explosion which contaminates the islanders on Rongelap and some of the other Marshall Islands, and it also contaminates the 23 crew members aboard the Lucky Dragon 5 fishing vessel that was contaminated, and they bring back the fish that's been irradiated, and that starts to get dispersed on markets before they realize what had happened to them. And so there's a panic internationally. But the biggest effect was in Japan. The anti-nuclear sentiment that had been festering in Japan but had been somewhat subdued because of post-war censorship on the part of the United States. Actually, in the post-war period, in Japan, they were not allowed to discuss the atomic bombings. They were not allowed to write about it. They were not allowed to do research on the medical effects. There was the censorship by the U.S. military in Japan meant that there was very little discussion, but that had been festering under the surface. And once the Lucky Dragon incident occurred, Japan explodes. And some housewives in Tokyo begin a petition drive, and the anti-nuclear petition that they circulate was signed by one-third of all the Japanese people. So there's this vast anti-nuclear sentiment. In order to change the mindset in Japan, it's going to require a multifaceted effort. So the USIA and the State Department and the CIA begin to work with allies in Japan, one of whom was Shuriki. Shuriki was the founder of Japanese baseball, a good thing. He was also the president of the Yomiuri Shimbun, as well as Japanese television networks, a very powerful, influential man in Japan, and he's America's leading ally in this effort.
How politically aligned was he domestically?
Well, he was a former war criminal, a Class A war criminal who the U.S. had let out, in the same way that Prime Minister Shinzo Abe's grandfather was a Class A war criminal who the U.S. exonerated so that we could use him politically, and then Kishi becomes the prime minister in the late 50s, and he's the one who oversees the railroading through the defense treaty with the United States, and then it's so unpopular he gets thrown out of office by the Japanese people. But that's Abe's grandfather. Abe's grandfather's younger brother was also a Japanese prime minister who worked hand in glove with the United States in spreading America's nuclear military policies in Japan. That's another story. But Shuriki is very, very useful. He's tied in with the LDP, the ruling party for decades in Japan, and he becomes a key element in this campaign inside Japan, working with the Japanese media, working with the Japanese government, which the U.S. had largely installed in the post-war period, in order to try to change the mindset of the Japanese people. And they begin a vast propaganda campaign.
Mm.
Murray, who was one of the members of the Atomic Energy Commission in the United States, proposed with another U.S. representative that they actually locate the first nuclear power plant overseas in the city of Hiroshima. And the first time I ever took my students to Hiroshima, back in 1995, I take students on a study abroad class to Hiroshima and Nagasaki and Kyoto every summer as part of my Nuclear Studies Institute. But I was shocked to learn that 35% of Hiroshima's energy at that point came from nuclear power. And in Japan overall, before the Fukushima accident, 30% of Japanese nuclear power came from Japanese energy came from nuclear. So there still needs to be a big effort to convince the Japanese people. And as late as 1956, a small minority of Japanese were supportive of nuclear power use inside Japan. But then the campaign actually is ramped up even further, and finally a majority of Japanese are willing to go along. But they were not initially. They were initially very, very resistant, more resistant than any place else in the world, really. So to see nuclear power as being so widely accepted in Japan, and now the Abe administration again is trying to reopen those closed nuclear reactors across Japan.
Professor Kuznick, could you just maybe give us a little more clues about, or maybe a couple of details about the nature of this public relations campaign that was catalyzed under Matsutaro Shoriki? I mean, because,
yes.
I mean, you have to overcome things like Godzilla, which is kind of like the that in the very public imagination internationally associated with the bad aspects of nuclear energy. What did they do to hook the imaginations of the Japanese people on nuclear?
They began having fairs, exhibitions, interviews, films, a vast propaganda campaign. That they had these exhibitions that would move from city to city, and under the guise of promoting modern science and nuclear and studying about nuclear energy, nuclear atoms, and physics, they would be promoting nuclear power. And they really went from very, very limited support. The U.S. The USIA did a survey in 1956 that found that only 25% of the Japanese people thought that nuclear power would be more of a boon to mankind than a curse. And somehow they managed to turn that around so that initially, in 56, 70% of the Japanese people thought that nuclear power was harmful. But by 1958, they got that number down to 30%. So it was this vast campaign across Japan in conjunction with the Japanese government that finally convinces the Japanese people. Because Japan, as we know, is a resource-poor series of islands, and they didn't have their own energy. They needed to import energy to a large extent. And they were convinced that if they wanted to build up their economy, to modernize, to increase production, then nuclear would be the answer. They tried to do the same thing in the United States. The United States, the project that Eisenhower embraced was called Project Plowshares. And they had this bizarre idea that they were going to use hydrogen bombs to build harbors, to build a new Panama Canal, to unlock underground resources, oil and others, that were locked deep underground, for reservoirs underground. They were going to build new harbors in Alaska and other places by blasting them with hydrogen bombs. They thought that they could even divert hurricanes by changing the path of the hurricane by detonating hydrogen bombs alongside the hurricane route. This was craziness, and they seriously wanted to do this. The only reason Eisenhower wasn't able to begin this project in the late 50s was because there was a nuclear test ban agreement, and Eisenhower didn't want the test ban to break the test ban agreement because he feared it would give the Russians too much of a propaganda tool. And so that's the only reason they didn't start this insane program.
So I'm wondering then, because we know that Washington has such an interest in developing this nuclear age that we're in. And I spoke with Arnie Gunderson not too long ago, and he was talking about how indebted the banks are now, or there's so much investment in the bank, getting loans from the banks, that they need to get a return on that. And that's why we're seeing this restoration of nuclear energy, even though it seems clear right now the Japanese people are not interested. So could you maybe comment on how the economy of Japan is now in this hopeless entanglement with this directive toward nuclear power?
They've got 50 or so nuclear facilities that are shut down right now. And Abe has been promising to begin to reopen them. But it's crazy to think that in Japan, given the geology there, given the threat of tsunamis, given the instabilities in Japan, that this could ever be safe. I don't know if you saw, there was a very interesting article in the New York Times a few days ago on the anniversary of Fukushima that broke down the different categories of waste, of radioactive waste, and the amounts of radioactive waste that they have to try to deal with in Japan from that first accident are mind-boggling. They are vast, and they have still not been able to control the leakage of radioactive waste from the Fukushima accident. So to think that especially in Japan. I don't think that it's safe anywhere or worth the risk anywhere, but especially in Japan, given how unstable that geology is, to think that they would risk having another accident like the Fukushima accident, it really makes no sense at all. And the Japanese people are overwhelmingly opposed to this. But like a lot of other things that Abe has tried to do, he's ignoring Japanese public opinion. The same thing with Article 9 and his remilitarization programs. That is very, very unpopular still in Japan, and there's limits to how far he can push that, as there's been real constraints upon his trying to reopen the nuclear power plants in Japan.
Well, I think with that, we have to leave it there. But I want to thank you very much, Professor Kuznick, for that important overview.
My pleasure, Michael.
We've been speaking with Professor Peter Kuznick, Professor of History and Director of the Nuclear Studies Institute at American University in Washington, D.C. Nuclear power has frequently been touted as a way of mitigating climate change. However, nuclear is demonstrably not a solution. On the Fairwinds Energy Education website, you can find a couple of videos which debunk that claim. One is of a 30-minute presentation by Fairwinds chief engineer Arne Gundersen. It's called CO2 Smokescreen. The other is a short 2-minute feature simply called Smokescreen. We'll play the audio from that second feature for you right now.
In 2015, human activity released 35,810 million tons of CO2 into the atmosphere. In order to avoid catastrophic climate change, this number must quickly be reduced. Currently, our CO2 production grows by 2% every year as people worldwide seek a more affluent lifestyle. The World Nuclear Association, or WNA, has a plan to solve this problem, building 1,000 new nuclear reactors before the year 2050. That means we would need to build a nuclear reactor every 12 days for the next 33 years. Our existing reactors offset only 3% of global emissions. Every time a new reactor goes online, our carbon footprint goes down slightly, and only by this much. Along the way, outdated reactors must be decommissioned, the deadly waste must be tended in perpetuity, and each new reactor built will increase the probability of atomic disaster somewhere in the world. Constructing this infrastructure will cost $8.2 trillion. Even after spending all this money and waiting all this time, by the year 2050, these new nuclear reactors will have offset only 3.9 gigatons of CO2, which is less than 10% of the reduction that we need. The nuclear industry touts CO2 reduction to greenwash its agenda. For the nuclear industry, $8.2 trillion is good business. For humanity, it is an opportunity cost. Precious time and money wasted on the wrong thing. If we follow the WNA, another generation will pass and climate change will only get worse. We already have clean, cheap, and timely ways to reduce CO2 emissions, and nuclear power is not one of them. The nuclear solution to climate change is a smokescreen. We don't deny science. Help us protect the water you drink, the food you eat, and the air you breathe. Radiation knows no borders.
That was audio from the video Smokescreen. It is available free of charge on the website fairwinds.org. You're listening to the Global Research News Hour, broadcast out of Winnipeg on campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM and on the Progressive Radio Network at prn.fm. We are also podcast on the website globalresearch.ca.
On last week's program, we heard about the forces shaping the Canadian government's embrace of nuclear power, helping us understand Canada's response to and institutional connections with the Fukushima disaster specifically. We're joined once again by Gordon Edwards. He is co-founder and president of the Canadian Coalition for Nuclear Responsibility. Thanks for joining us again, Dr. Edwards.
My pleasure, Michael.
Dr. Edwards, could you comment on the institutional links between the Japanese nuclear sector, and I'm thinking particularly of the company TEPCO, and Canada?
Well, TEPCO is involved in uranium mining in Canada. They buy some of the uranium from Canada, and they also have interest in mining exploration activities in Saskatchewan. So yes, they are involved. And although the plants in Japan are not of Canadian design, they are American design, nevertheless, there is a similarity between all nuclear power plants. And in that sense, the Canadian nuclear plants have the same vulnerabilities that the Japanese plants have. That is, in the event of a total shutdown, a total blackout, no power at all, it would be impossible to remove the radioactive decay heat from the core of the reactor, even if the reactor is completely shut down, as the Fukushima reactors were. You still cannot shut off the radioactivity. And the radioactivity is so intense that it will drive the temperatures higher and higher to 5,000 degrees Fahrenheit, which is 2,800 degrees Celsius, which will cause melting of the fuel of the, really cause a core meltdown. And that will happen in any large-scale nuclear reactor without any ability to remove the decay heat, the radioactive decay heat, as rapidly as it is produced.
Mm. So one would think that there would be some, information sharing about, how to address those situations with regard to the, in the event of a possible meltdown or efforts to mitigate such a meltdown. How do you see Canadian regulators and Japanese regulators? Are they kind of aligning forces in a way that would improve the situation overall?
I'm unaware of any really close connection between the Japanese regulators and the Canadian regulators. However, it is notable that just this past week, in fact, there was a court ruling in Japan which found TEPCO and the government of Japan criminally liable for the accident at Fukushima, because there were, in fact, studies done that predicted the possibility of a large tsunami, which is really what caused the damage, not so much the earthquake. It was the tsunami that drowned the emergency backup electrical systems, and that's what made it impossible to remove that radioactive decay heat and cause the meltdowns. Now, in Canada, as in Europe and elsewhere in the world, the authorities have taken very close note of the fact that emergency backup electrical systems are extremely important. And so they have taken steps to have portable systems that can be brought in fairly quickly to supply extra cooling, to supply extra electricity. The difficulty with these portable systems is that they do not have the ability to run for long periods of time. So even in Japan, they had backup batteries, which they did use, but those batteries only last for a matter of hours, and then they're no longer able to run those gigantic pumps that are necessary to cool the core of the reactor. So there has been study done. There have been improvements in emergency, especially mobile equipment that can be brought in. There have also been some improvements in standalone reactors, like the one in New Brunswick, the one which does not have a vacuum building. A vacuum building is a separate device for sucking up the radioactive gases in the event of such an accident. When you have a single standalone reactor, you don't have that separate building. And so there they have installed what's called a vented, filtered evacuation, which will allow the worst of the radioactivity to be filtered out of any exhaust from the reactor.
Were these changes made before Fukushima or since?
No, they were made since, and they were in response to the accident itself. One of the great difficulties in Canada, which is rather unique, is that in the case of Fukushima, those reactors were 250 kilometers away from the large city of Tokyo, whereas in Ontario, we have the Pickering reactors, which are only 5 kilometers from the eastern edge of Toronto, and within 40 kilometers of the Pickering reactors, you have 4.5 million people living. So the idea of evacuation is something which has been flagged by the Toronto City Hall, the Toronto councillors, and also by the Canadian Environmental Law Association. The feeling is that we really have no idea how to evacuate Toronto in the event of such a major accident. And we have some concern about the true independence of our regulator. You know, another thing that happened in Fukushima was the Japanese Parliament, which is called the Diet, commissioned a separate study of the causes of the Fukushima accident. And one of the shocking findings of that study was that a large part of the responsibility, and in fact the ultimate cause of the accident, in their view, was the collusion between the government and the regulator and the industry, that all three were in collusion to suppress certain warnings about nuclear safety. Now, there are indications that similar things are happening here in Canada, because nuclear experts have come forward in the last few years, since Fukushima, people who have spent decades in the nuclear industry working as nuclear experts. One of them is in Toronto. His name is Dr. Nijawan, and he has spent his really professional lifetime studying the progress of severe nuclear accidents in CANDU reactors. And he's identified 30 or 40 different design weaknesses in the Canadian reactors, which would not allow them to be built under today's standards. And he is urging the authorities, because right now they're embarking upon a major, very costly refurbishment of the Darlington reactors. It's going to cost $13 billion to fix them up. And he's urging that they incorporate some of these design changes, or most of these design changes, into the refurbishment plans, so that the reactor is a whole lot safer in terms of resisting the pressures that cause some of the worst consequences of a nuclear accident. Mm. For instance, people might remember seeing on their television screens those explosions that occurred. There were three gigantic explosions.
Hydrogen explosions.
They were hydrogen gas explosions. But where did the hydrogen gas come from? Well, the hydrogen gas comes because the heat of the radioactivity drives the temperature up to about 1,800 degrees Celsius. And at that temperature, the metal reacts with the steam to what happens is the metal gets oxidized. It takes the oxygen out of the water molecules and releases the hydrogen gas. So the hydrogen gas comes about as a result of the heat of the radioactivity causing a chemical reaction with the metal. And you get a large amount of hydrogen gas produced. And that's where the explosions come from. Well, in Canada, we have something called hydrogen recombiners, which are designed to reconvert that hydrogen, to basically burn that hydrogen back into water. The difficulty is, however, that according to Dr. Nijawan, they have seriously underestimated the amount of hydrogen that would be produced in the event of a severe accident. And therefore, they should redesign the entire hydrogen gas management system. That's only one of 30 to 40 different recommendations made by Dr. Nijawan. Mm. Now, the problem is that both the regulator and the industry are very reluctant to accept these recommendations because it would add to the cost, and the cost is already enormous. Like $13 billion just to fix up the Darlington reactors, which only cost $14 billion to build in the first place. So it's a very high price tag, and unfortunately we have a history of these prices, these estimated prices, of going way over budget, so that you could easily see a doubling or tripling of that amount making it prohibitively expensive. So there is this, even though the regulator is not supposed to be concerned with such matters as cost, they're only supposed to be concerned with safety issues. But as we saw in Japan, there is a kind of a cozy relationship between the regulator and the industry that makes it difficult to really enforce the safety to the full extent.
I wanted to get one last thought for you about the way the Canadian government responded to the disaster as it happened. I mean, are there things that we should have done better in terms of the, well, you mentioned the hydrogen explosion and some of the radioactivity that was released from there, concerns about the food. I mean, are there, from Japan, are there things that the Canadian government should have done to protect Canadians that maybe they didn't do?
Well, I think that something which has been really overlooked is the Great Lakes. All of our reactors are sitting right on the Great Lakes, and one of the things that has been very apparent at the Fukushima in the aftermath of the Fukushima disaster is a tremendous amount, 300 tons a day going into the Pacific Ocean of quite highly contaminated water. Also, we have seen in Fukushima the fact that they have to, even after the cores of those reactors melted down, they still have to pump about 400 tons of water a day down into those molten cores. And when they come back up again, the water is extremely radioactive. They've already built over 1,500 huge steel tanks to contain this contaminated water, much too radioactive to allow into the environment. And are we prepared for that in Canada? Do we actually have plans to manage the water problems? Because almost all the discussion has gone into simply matters of prevention, which makes sense, of course. You want to prevent the accident from occurring in the first place. But you mustn't put so much emphasis on the prevention to overlook the fact that the impossible can happen. You have to learn to think the unthinkable. And if you do think that far, then you have to realize that protection of the Great Lakes has got to be of paramount importance. There's over 40 million people in both the United States and Canada who draw their drinking water from the Great Lakes. And, of course, it goes down through the St. Lawrence River as well. So that's something which I think has been not dealt with properly at the present time.
Dr. Gordon Edwards, it's been a pleasure having you on the show. Thank you very much for clarifying those details for us.
My pleasure. Thank you.
We've been joined by Dr. Gordon Edwards. He is president of the Canadian Coalition for Nuclear Responsibility. With the Japanese government dismissing concerns about the Fukushima Daiichi nuclear catastrophe in the lead-up to the 2020 Summer Olympics and during the month when evacuees from the prefecture are seeing their compensation for living abroad being withdrawn, we turn now to the resistance among the Japanese people to nuclear power. Joining us from her office in Kyoto, Japan, is Eileen Miyoko Smith, Executive Director of Green Action, a Kyoto-based non-governmental environmental organization dedicated to creating a nuclear power-free Japan. Eileen Miyoko Smith has, over the course of her lengthy involvement in anti-nuclear campaigns, interviewed hundreds of survivors of the Three Mile Island meltdown. She has, since the 1980s, been a leading figure in the resistance against nuclear power in Japan. In 1988, she organized a petition drive which collected nearly 4 million signatures favoring the phase-out of nuclear power in the country. In August 2010, she was instrumental in putting together a large-scale campaign involving hundreds of initiatives and NGOs, all pointing out the risks associated with nuclear power, including earthquakes. She's also the recipient of an award from the Nuclear Free Future Award Foundation in October of 2014 in Munich. Eileen Miyoko Smith, thank you so much for making the time to speak with us.
Well, it's great to have the opportunity. Thank you.
Now, I wonder if you could just maybe, take us over the last 6 years or so, the current state of the anti-nuclear movement in Japan, and maybe any evolution that it's undergone since Fukushima.
Okay. Well, as everybody can probably imagine, the accident 6 years ago was a tremendous shock to everybody. Not only did we have a serious earthquake and tsunami that killed many people immediately, tens of thousands of people had to be evacuated because of the radiation from the Fukushima Daiichi plant. As the accident unfolded, it became known that it was even endangering large metropolitan areas like Tokyo. And it was only months later and years later that we really realized how lucky we were in that the accident could have been by far worse, where a whole swathe of Japan, half the population, would have had to permanently leave the area where they live. So since then, of course, the opposition against nuclear power has risen tremendously. I think the world is astounded that the government is even trying to get nuclear power restarted. We had 54 reactors at the time of the Fukushima Daiichi accident. Some of the older reactors have been permanently shut down, but there's still 43 reactors in Japan. And the government and Japanese electricity utilities are trying to restart half of them. So there's been a big battle in Japan to keep the nuclear power plants shut. Until after Fukushima, we were always told that if we didn't have nuclear power, there'd be blackouts in Japan and the Japanese economy would collapse, etc. But after the Fukushima accident, we went 2 years, nearly 2 years, with zero nuclear power. And the public now realizes that actually we don't need it in order to sustain our economy. What's been really very exciting and good is that every 6 years, we've replaced half of the power that nuclear power supplied with energy efficiency and renewables. So we're already well halfway to making zero nuclear power in Japan. But the government is trying to still restart. Right now we have 36 lawsuits throughout Japan trying to stop the various plants. And up until before Fukushima, we always lost all the lawsuits. But we've had 10 verdicts since Fukushima, and we've won 4 of them, including an injunction where a reactor that got started had to be shut down. 2 reactors that were restarted had to be shut down the next day. So it's an ongoing battle. The majority of people do not want restart, but the government and utilities are aggressively moving forward. And the government's even given approval for aging reactors that are 40 years old to get a life extension to 60. So we're fighting at so many fronts that it's almost hard to keep track of each one. The seismic issue is, of course, huge because it's now obvious that the Japanese government has underestimated the dangers of earthquakes and nuclear power plants. And it's now very clear that it's been underestimated. And now the co-chair, head of the Nuclear Regulation Authority, after he left, has challenged the nuclear regulation, the same authority that he was co-chair of, on the seismic issue, saying that the government's estimates are way, way low, underestimated, and that the reactors are dangerous for restart.
You mentioned a few things there about the campaigns. You said 36 lawsuits, and also a transition. You'd say like transitioning to through safe, affordable, and sustainable methods to replace a lot of what's been generated by nuclear, which is a really amazing development. It's unfortunate it's not getting more exposure. Is there any?
Well, actually, even the Japanese public, even the anti-nuclear movement, is not aware that we've actually replaced half already with energy efficiency and renewables. The energy efficiency part has been the most exciting. What Tokyo did after Fukushima, it was, of course, having to become, you know, less nuclear power immediately, and it was draconian. But the long-term effects have been really good. There have been questionnaires done for medium-sized and large businesses, and they're actually glad that they were forced to reduce their consumption of electricity because it's been giving them long-term economic benefits after that.
Were there any maybe high-profile public demonstrations or rallies, possibly controversial, that maybe should be highlighted or underscored?
Well, after the accident for about a year and a half, 2 years, it still continues. Every Friday evening, there's a demonstration in front of the Prime Minister's office, which is right next to the Diet offices, in other words, like the legislature. And it was just amazing what happened in Japan that had never happened before, and that is that most people in public never go to demonstrations or do anything like that, but there were, like, moms with their baby carriages. There were salary men that usually go out drinking Friday night right after work. They came by to the demonstrations before they went out drinking. It was just a whole huge number of people that had never been to a demonstration before. And a number of them would be just standing kind of on the, as part of the demonstration, but not even knowing how to chant or say anything, but they wanted to be there and be part of the numbers. So that was really exciting, and it's the numbers held down. The police cordon off the areas, and you can't really be in one place together. So it's gone way down, but I think that changed, that created a paradigm shift in the Japanese public's eyes. So that's been a big change. Otherwise, it's been more, you know, it's less visible, so it's hard to keep the momentum up, because the majority, we have polls, and the majority of the Japanese people definitely don't want to have reactors restarted. But we still feel like, as, you know, anti-nuclear NGOs, still slugging away like we're kind of on the fringe of society, kind of working at it, and the rest of society just kind of doesn't say anything. And that's a real difficulty in Japan, because people don't speak up very much.
According to opinion polls I've seen, it's like 4 in 5 Japanese are favoring an ultimate or even immediate phase out. So how do you account for a pro-nuclear prime minister like Shinzo Abe getting elected?
Well, first of all, the government at the beginning was very effective in saying, look, you have to be practical. If we shut down nuclear power, they'll be devastating the Japanese economy, and people believe that. But then when the reactors didn't get restarted, because more stringent standards got put in place and it wasn't that easy to restart reactors, then people realized, hey, you know, we don't need it. Then they said replacement power with fossil fuels is a huge, incredible burden for Japan. And yet people didn't really feel it, except that at every election, they're told, you know, people take, okay, is it economy or safety? Which do we want? Well, of course, safety is the most important. But since many of the reactors are shut down, not many have restarted. Even if a few restart, well, maybe we'll be able to be okay. But the economy is so immediate, and so people believe that the Abe Shinzo government will be the best for the economy of Japan, so they opt for that. And actually, nuclear power is bad for Japan's economy, because it's holding back renewables. You know, utilities are saving the grid for nuclear power restart, when there are all these new companies that are, energy efficiency and conservation and renewables and everything, and creating a good, clean energy, but they can't send it on the power lines because the power lines are saved for nuclear power restart. It's really delaying Japan changing over to a better efficiency program and a better renewable program. So if that message gets across to the Japanese public, it'd be great.
Now, what about this issue of, like, the withdrawal of compensation? There's a kind of an economic pressure for people who've evacuated to return to areas that they probably shouldn't be returning to. Is there any campaign around that?
There is a campaign. There are 180,000 people still evacuated, and the majority of them are evacuated because of the radiation. But the Japanese government is having a really, really big push to have things, quote unquote, normal by 2020 when the Olympics are going to be in Japan. And so we really need the international community to say you cannot force people to go back into levels of radiation that are so high. I mean, 20 millisieverts annual is the standard for the contaminated area, when the rest of Japan has 1/20th of radiation as a standard. So it's really unfair to force people who've been in the disaster, the Fukushima accident contamination area, to go back to those areas that have really levels of contamination, which are not even allowed in radiation control areas like hospitals, et cetera. You know, in a hospital, you'd have to decontaminate yourself before you come out to the rest of the hospital where, you know, outpatients are around. Well, whole swathes of the countryside, children and babies are living in that contaminated area that's too contaminated to have regular people go in and out. So it's just so unfair, and we've written to the UN, but the Japanese government won't let the UN come in and write up research and write up a report, a human rights report on the issue. So it's really difficult. But the biggest thing is the housing compensation, because people who've evacuated have had subsidies for being able to live outside of the area. But now those subsidies are going as of, in a few weeks, and we're trying to keep those subsidies going.
I am curious to know about the media in Japan, the major media that people in Japan are being exposed to, and if they're getting adequate information about the hazards and, you know, maybe a responsible portrayal of the resistance and groups like yours.
The portrayal is still minimal. We don't get in the media that much. That's a problem. But, you know, we've had these big lawsuit wins, like this injunction, which is like nationwide front page lead headline, where the utility actually has to shut down an operating nuclear power plant because the court says it's not safe. So there are times when we are in the media in a really major way. But another time when we were able to practically force, I mean, we got 108 Diet members to sign a petition saying a reactor site earthquake, a fault had to be reexamined. And that was front page, huge headlines. And yet, year later, they were able to make the fault line go away and reactors approval has been given. So it's a tug of war in a way. That's going on. And as far as the contamination of the Fukushima Daiichi area or the prefectures and the surrounding areas, it's a real battle because people are living there still. And I mean, there are many people living there. And it's a big battle between people want to pretend radiation is disappeared, and it's almost their livelihoods is dependent on making those areas normal again, versus people who've evacuated who don't want to come back. So it's almost taboo to talk about radiation in the contaminated areas, and so there's a big rift between amongst the people that have been affected by the accident, those that want to get back to normal and those that say, no, we cannot go back into the areas.
I think we'll have to close at this point, but I want to thank you very much for joining us. And
okay.
And all the best in the campaigns moving forward.
Okay. Thank you. Okay. Bye-bye.
We've been speaking with Eileen Miyoko-Smith, Executive Director of Green Action, a Kyoto-based anti-nuclear group. The group's website is greenaction-japan.org. You've been listening to the Global Research News Hour. You can listen to our programs every week on CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg and on partnering radio stations across Canada and the United States. We are now also broadcast on the Progressive Radio Network at prn.fm. You can also download each episode from the website globalresearch.ca. To leave feedback on this program, email globalresearchnewshour@gmail.com. I'm series host, creator, and producer Michael Welch. Join us again next week.